Manina, can I ask you about your name? Do you get all sorts of queries about it? I'm sorry, I'm the Irish version of Maureen, and people call me all sorts of everything. So I was just wondering about the Manina and where it came from.
Oh, yeah, every day, every day. Well, I think it must come from the Irish for Maineen, oh, yes. My daughter.
Okay.
It sounds like that. I was the first of five, so there's Maineen in the three Carcuig. I'm Ivara Hain anyway.
Welcome to Lighting a Fire, all things teaching and learning with the Teaching Council.
Welcome to the Teaching Council's podcast. We're absolutely delighted to launch our Lighting a Fire podcast, which we hope will inspire and inform teachers, parents, students, and indeed the wider public. We want this podcast to stimulate conversations, not just here and now, but after you listen to it and share it with your colleagues and have more conversations with them, to share information, connect with fellow teachers, connect with parents and students about the issues we're going to explore over this podcast series. Why start this podcast series? And I suppose the best place to start would be in terms of we have a fairly strong track record in the Teaching Council through a number of different channels, such as FAILSA, our annual festival to mark World Teachers Day, our CREE research webinar series, our Learning for All webinar series. We have a keen interest in representing all voices, teachers, parents, students, and all voices in the wider community in discussions in education, discussions that allow for wider conversation on those topics. And typically we've gone for panels, let's say, of 4 to 5 people trying to represent those voices within the one discussion. But with the podcast series, we think there's a real opportunity to go deeper. So still keeping that broad brushstroke, I suppose, vigilance for teaching and learning. That's what we're all about, the Teaching Council, quality teaching and learning. But episode by episode, person by person, exploring more in depth, how does the system work? How does it not work for people? What are the issues arising? What are bubbling up? And through the more perhaps relaxed and formal context of a podcast, explore these issues more in a curious and intrigued way very often, and hopefully a joyful way as well. So to delve the issues into greater depth, and we do aim to represent a broad range of issues, a broad range of voices over the course of the series. But in any one podcast, it's going to be typically one guest person. Our guest today, I'm delighted to say, is someone who actually I first met in a Common Purpose Leadership Programme, must be all of 10 years ago, and her name is Monina Griffith. She's the CEO of Belong to Youth Services, that's Ireland's national organisation for LGBTI plus young people. Monina, you're most welcome to our inaugural podcast.
Delighted to be here.
Brilliant. And we're also experimenting, folks, with another innovation in terms of the format. We're going to have a guest host on each episode, because I think a bit too much of me is a bit too much for a lot of people. So Marnie Kelleher, who comes from Dublin West Education Centre and also a primary principal of Gaelscoil in Monmouth. She's our very first guest host. Marnie's been involved in education for more than 30 years in different roles as director of the National Induction Programme for Teachers, the director of Dublin West Education Centre and as principal of a primary school. Award in the fall, Sir Ruth.
And I'm really looking forward to this conversation. I think the idea of a podcast is wonderful. I think the Teaching Council pioneered with webinars, and now you're pioneering with podcasts. So I hope they will be listened to. And you and I discussed the tagline, I suppose, of lighting fires. And
yes.
Recently, I read a book called Little Fires Everywhere. And when I heard the lighting fires, I thought of all those conversations in all those staff rooms and in corridors all over the country. If this would spark those conversations, we might indeed light little fires everywhere and get the discussion going. So that's what I'm hoping for out of the podcast series. And it's great to be involved in the first one.
Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. So Monina, I think as hope is clear at this stage, very much a conversation. Feel free to ask us questions, challenges in our thinking, or maybe our implicit assumptions in our questions, and let's see where the conversation goes. So I want to start, I suppose, we propose to start a podcast episode, Monina, with the same question of our guests. And given that education impacts on almost every single person's lives every single day, there's a million students and young people in our primary and post-primary schools. When you consider their parents, their families, their extended families, their communities, every day, people around the country are talking about school. How was school today? Thankfully, you, I, and Maureen are in the position that we're at school is well behind us at this stage, where we've got various experiences behind us in terms of career. Can I ask you, Monina, what was school like for you growing up?
Well, it's a long time ago now. very different. I loved primary school, absolutely adored primary school. And I had some great teachers who I loved, still think fondly about Mrs. Woods, a lovely teacher I had in third and fourth class. And she'd bring us outside to draw. And, you know, she was just wonderful. And I she introduced us to all sorts of wonderful things, including at the time I was very interested in becoming a nun. I've changed my mind since, but she was really into St. Therese of Lisieux and the little flower missions. And I used to do bake sales and send the Carmelite nuns in the UK, whatever, 10p or whatever I'd raise. So, but she was just a wonderful teacher, and she made learning fun. And I kind of got my swottiness then, because it's all about pleasing her and making sure I did well in my tests and that. But she also kind of developed that kind of creative side in children, which I think is something beautiful in the primary school system that is kind of, I think, stamped out a little bit. But by the time we come to post-primary, I think there's, you know, we've got, there isn't much I'd change in the primary school, my own primary school experience, and my own daughter's in primary school at the moment. And it's just still that wonderful kind of awe-inspiring excitement and creative kind of atmosphere. So education is obviously the central focus, but it's just much more holistic and obviously not focused on exams and careers and what you want to be when you grow up. It's about, well, who are you now and what do you like doing now? So primary school was wonderful. Secondary school I wasn't so fond of, for all those reasons. Okay. I found it very stifling. I was a very opinionated young person. I've been brought up to be like that. And I found it very difficult to be like that in secondary school. So I would have come in into conflict, I suppose, with leadership in the school because of that. And and my academic, I think, side of me would have suffered as a result, because I was seen as a troublemaker and kind of dismissed as that, instead of realizing that I actually had brains. And when I did well in my Leaving Cert, I think a lot of the teachers were surprised. They thought it was just a troublemaker and a pain in the neck. But I did have a brain, and I found my voice, I suppose, as a teenager, and that continued into my professional career and continues now. But it's certainly not something that was encouraged when I was in secondary school anyway. You know, standing up for what you thought was right and what you saw was wrong in the classroom. So very happy memories of primary school, not so much of secondary school.
Nina, that's very interesting. Very affirmed as a primary school principal that you you felt you had a good experience in primary school. That warms my heart quite a lot.
Yeah.
Just interested in the secondary school piece. Surprisingly enough, I would have been an opinionated person too. What kind of things got you into trouble? You know, it's really interesting there. You say, you know, I was seen as a troublemaker. What were the issues that that came up for you that you felt you had to stand up about?
Things that I perceived as unjust, I suppose. I remember a girl, a classmate, falling over and hurting herself in the class, and because we'd been giddy, and I suppose the teacher was trying to keep control of us, wouldn't let her leave to, you know, to have the cut looked at. And okay. I stood up to the teacher about that. I said that wasn't, you know, if she got a bad old cut, she'd been swinging on her chair, as lots of us do and did, and slipped and then fell and, you know, conked herself on the desk, that kind of stuff. So, I mean, I got into fierce trouble about that, but it was kind of, I think I was pegged as a troublemaker even before I came in. I had a cousin who'd been a little bit, bit wild, but Fionn, as they were said, and
a family treat.
You know, it was kind of like, oh, you know. So any time I opened my mouth, then it was like she's going to give us give us, you know, guff. I also think that there's sometimes, I mean, not to get into it too much, but I think sometimes there can be, you know, because I have quite a, you know, a South County Dublin accent. And I think that people then sometimes think, oh, well, if you know, middle class, blah, 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 no problems at home, she's fine and she's just acting up. When actually there were lots of things going on for me, and but it was kind of hidden. So I think there was a less, I think the thing is in secondary school as well, your teachers know you less, don't they?
Yeah.
Whereas in primary school, they get to know you as a human being, as a person, whereas you're only in their class 40 minutes or an hour or whatever it is per day. And so it's just a very different relationship.
It is. I think you're right about the relationality of teaching. It's one of the, and especially primary school teaching, when you are with those children all the time. And just my own experience, I had a very good, both primary and post-primary. Not everybody. I didn't get on with everybody in post-primary, but it would have been, despite my opinionatedness, a very positive experience. But I think that was kind of channeled into things like public speaking and debating by a very wise principal who gave me an outlet.
Great.
And I think that helped me a lot. So it's interesting to, but I do think the relationship piece is particularly important.
And I think that the teachers didn't have I think I started struggling with anxiety after my intercert, and I found fifth and sixth year very difficult. And again, I think the teachers just didn't know how to deal with it. I remember sitting in classrooms crying, tears streaming down my face, and teachers not saying anything, not doing anything. And I'd hope that doesn't go on today. You know, I would think that teachers have more confidence and more training and more awareness about what to do and how to support young people who are struggling. Whereas back then, I suppose they didn't. And it was just wasn't spoken about in the same way, you know, 20 years ago.
Well, I think it's come on a lot, all right, Moni, in many ways, but I'm still very struck by your account insofar as there's a lot of assumption going on. I'm very particularly struck with the example of, you know, your cousin before you was a troublemaker, so therefore you were deemed to be a troublemaker, layered by the South Dublin accent and whatever. How much of it was people not giving themselves permission to allow our vulnerable humanity to be more acknowledged? As you say, there you were crying your eyes out in fifth and sixth year, and people, for whatever reason, not responding, not moving to acknowledge at the very least. So, but how much of it is about that sense of assuming they know who or what you are, that not being half the story, and not giving ourselves as a collective, you know, as teachers, parents, or students, the space or time to actually be vulnerable?
Yeah, well, I mean, that language didn't really exist when, you know, I'm 47. Yeah. So, I mean, it's a long time since I was in school, and that we wouldn't have had that language. And indeed, I mean, the school I went to, some of the teachers were young. Some of them had their own problems. I know one of my teachers subsequently died by suicide themselves. So, you know, everybody had stuff going on. And I think it was a different kind of Ireland. It was Ireland in the, you know, in the 80s and the 90s. We didn't have the language, and we didn't know how to talk about it. And even if we saw somebody struggling, I suppose it was like, oh God, I don't know what to do with it. And although there were teachers where, again, and this is where I think, you know, the kids who came from maybe different kind of a background, maybe didn't have the same accent as me, sometimes they were more heavily policed. That's for sure. But sometimes they're also more supported. Mm-hmm. So, you know, different approaches, different teachers had different approaches. But anyway, they didn't like me. I had two teachers that liked me, a lovely English teacher and a lovely Irish teacher, who are great. And but, you know, and I still have friends from school. So, I mean, it wasn't all bad, but I wouldn't be rushing back there.
No, I can appreciate that absolutely, Monique. And I'm very taken with your comment about the language issue back then, the language of vulnerability and so on wasn't part of the lexicon. You're now chief executive of Belong Too. And I've read of your annual report, the survey with some kind of a concerning statistics in some respects. I mean, we can say on the one hand, we've come a long, long way. I'm open to correction on this, but the first country to, by popular vote, provide for same-sex marriage in our constitution. And yet, And yet, you know, there were some of the findings in terms of the experience of LGBTI plus students in schools. There's quite a mixed picture. How far do you think we've come? How much further do we have to go in that space, do you think?
Well, I mean, a huge way since I was in school. I mean, we didn't even have the language. I don't think I ever even heard the word lesbian when I was in school.
Right.
You know, I think there was, I would have heard the word gay and definitely used in a very pejorative way about some of the boys in the boys' school, you know. There was really no discussion and definitely no visibility and no discussion about any playwrights or any history or in any subject, in any curriculum, across any subject. There was no visibility of LGBT identities or experiences. I mean, we've come a long way now and there are amazing schools really leading the way in terms of, being inclusive and making sure that policies and training and awareness and that young people, all students, including LGBT students, feel really visible, valued and included in their schools. I've visited and met with lots of students and teachers from different schools who are doing great things. But you probably saw in our annual report, we referred to the school climate report that we ran last year. And I think that even for me, I found that quite startling. I knew from young people who attend, belong to services, who use our services, our support services, that school can be an area that it can, you know, be traumatic for some young people because they experience homophobic bullying or transphobic bullying, or they feel excluded, or, you know, they can't be out, and that stigma and that shame then can have a really negative impact on their mental health and well-being. But what that research showed us was that over 70% of LGBT students don't feel safe in schools, and that was quite gobsmacking for me, you know. And the description of, you know, some of their experiences, so some of it was from what we would think might be innocuous enough, kind of, are not intentional, off the cuff remarks, that happen, right up to physical violence, damage to property, online stuff, right up to sexual violence, you know. So really horrific story. So young people answered a number of quite a long survey, and then we left them with space to record some more personal stuff as well. So there was one young man who described being sexually assaulted after PE for 3 years by boys in his class because he was gay. So I mean, really quite horrific stuff. The more common stuff, I suppose, is the day-to-day exclusion, the day-to-day kind of language signaling that there's something wrong with being LGBT, the use of homework is so gay, the rain is so gay, everything negative being described as gay. And what a young person described it to us as is like, it's like a paper cut. So one paper cut isn't too bad, but if you hear, if you get a paper cut, 10 paper cuts a day, 5 days a week, for your entire school life, that can have a huge impact on your health and well-being. And what we know is, you know, 12 is the most common age for a young person to realize that they might be LGBT, but it can be much, much younger, especially for young trans people. But anyway, 12 is the most common age. 16 then is the most common age for them to tell another human being. So that's 4 years can be a very lonely, very isolating time. And it's also the time, unsurprisingly, that we see a spike in things like self-harm and suicide ideation amongst LGBT students. So there's a lot of work to be done to make sure that school feels safe and that young people feel that it is a place that they belong, and that staff and parents and boards of management and the whole school community really are working together to make sure that students aren't, you know, experiencing their school years as traumatic and aren't skipping school or leaving school early. I mean, this is the other thing we found, that, you know, quite a number of LGBT young people have leave school early because of their experiences. So would be why in second chance education, you know, we in our work with post-primary and youth reach, and that we know that there's a higher than maybe expected number of LGBT young people in youth reach and other spaces like this, because post-primary school can be such a battlefield for them. It's sometimes they just give up altogether. So a lot of work to be done.
Well, that's clearly fascinating. It's quite sobering, but fascinating. And I suppose I was a primary school principal for nearly 20 years. And I would definitely, I think marriage equality was fabulous when it happened, because it just normalized so much for the children in primary school. And I saw a definite change in the tone of conversation with primary school children. And also in my last 3 or 4 years, I came out in secondment 5 years ago. So in my last 3 or 4 years, we would have had the first fifth and sixth class pupils coming out in primary school. I wouldn't have seen it until then. We would have had children that we would have been aware probably LGBT and may or may not have had discussions with their parents. And I also found, as in the last few years in my principalship, that it was one of the things the post-primary schools asked me about. Were there any sixth class pupils who were transferring that we felt were gay or would be victimized for their sexuality? And again, that was something very new. And what came across me when I read the report was, maybe as a principal, I felt we had become a little bit complacent, that this was all right now, that everything was okay now. So it was quite sobering for me to read those statistics and to look what you say about that 4 years, that 12 to 16 years, how crucial that is. 12 to 16 years old. What can we do to make that easier?
Well, I think there's loads we can do. I think it's about creating an environment, you know, like a culture. So once-off trainings here and there, as helpful as they are, aren't enough. Mm. We have to approach it like we would. It's a societal issue. So I mean, we have to approach it with more than one thing in our tool belt, if you like. So, I mean, we have to look at our policies. We have to update, make sure our policies, they should all be in compliance now anyway with, you know, the action plan on bullying and the circular in 2013 that said it has to include homophobic and transphobic bullying. All that stuff needs to be updated, make sure that everybody is aware of it, that learners and parents and staff, everybody is aware of this, that kind of behavior, that kind of language isn't tolerated in school, that it's fundamental. The other thing is it's about making sure that the staff feel confident and competent and are aware of, you know, the policy context and, you know, their obligations and also feel comfortable addressing it. I mean, one of the things that came across that I was quite shocked about was the number of young people who said teachers who had witnessed homophobic or transphobic bullying and didn't intervene. And I don't think it's because they condone that. I think it's out of a lack of confidence of how do I do that? How do I, you know, jump in there and say something about it? So I think it's really important that teachers and all staff, not just teaching staff, but especially teaching staff, have the confidence and the competence then to support a young person who might be coming out or might be experiencing you know, hardship because of coming out or because of being bullied or whatever, and B, then how they would address homophobic and transphobic bullying in the classroom and the school if they witness it or if it's reported to them. I think the other things then are, you know, making sure that the building itself that feels welcoming and inclusive. So there's very simple ways of doing that. Like we're going to talk hopefully a little bit about Stand Up, the annual campaign that belong to runs with post-primary schools across Ireland. I mean, engaging in that. Obviously, that week is really important in every November. It'll be our 11th year this year running it. But throughout the year, you know, things like having Belong To posters up, having representatives from the local LGBT group in to talk to students, having rainbow flags around, teachers wearing, you know, rainbow pins or things like that, just as a little visual cue to LGBT students that they're an ally. There's loads and loads of the myriad ways you can make your school feel more welcoming and inclusive that most students won't see, but LGBT students will definitely see, and it'll make them feel more welcome and included. And then direct support to young people. So, you know, there's lots of different ways different schools do this. So, I mean, one is engaging with the local LGBT youth group and, you know, having that close relationship with the youth workers, them coming into the school, the teacher maybe getting to know the youth club and, you know, referring young people into them. Some schools actually run and support LGBT groups, GSAs, gender sexuality alliances in schools for young people to run. I mean, these are just some of the ways, of basic kind of ways that we can really upskill ourselves and just make the environment, the school climate, just much more inclusive and more welcoming. And we know from, you know, even the minimal amount of intervention in that school climate report, students said that even having one teacher that you know has your back is going to make it much, much more likely that you'll stay in school. You know, it really takes very little just for them to know that they have one friend, one ally in the school is usually enough for a student to feel, you know, that sense of, I suppose, more resilience and that they can get through this, you know.
I think it's also really important, just the leadership piece. We had received a letter to this organisation earlier in the year from a gay post-primary student talking about health and well-being. And it was in the context of CPD for teachers, which is what the Education Centre is about. And the interesting thing about his letter was that he wasn't ascribing it to it being a Catholic school, which it was, or that there wasn't well-being going on. But he did point to the school leadership as being vitally important and the attitude of the school leader. And we know, I suppose, from everything that the culture of any or an organization can depend hugely on the attitudes and the personality and the beliefs and the values and the vision of the leader of that organization. And maybe there is a piece of work there to be done targeting school leadership on culture of organizations.
Absolutely. And then the other thing is the curriculum itself, you know, and I know that the NCCA is looking at that at the moment in the context of relationship, sexuality, education. But I mean, it can be broader than that. I mean, you can bring, you know, I remember a young woman when I started in Belong To telling me that, you know, she had in an English class, they were talking about Oscar Wilde and she said, oh, he was gay. And she was told, oh, shh, we don't talk about that here. Like probably the most famous Irish gay man ever. Sorry, Senator David Morris, but being Oscar Wilde's probably more famous than him. And she was told not to, you know, so it's that kind of thing. And then that young person then internalizes it as, oh, that's something we shouldn't be talking about. There's something shameful or something about it. But, you know, just normalizing. And that's another thing. We've worked with some great teachers who've helped us develop our resources for stand-up so that, you know, if you're teaching geography or business, you can bring in examples of, you know, same-sex headed family households, or you can talk about the countries where marriage equality is legal. There's lots of different ways you can incorporate LGBT experiences. And again, that normalizes and sends a message out to LGBT young people. Yeah, you belong in this school. This is your space too. We see you, we value you, and we want to include your experience in your learning as well.
So in some respects, Monique, like I'm looking at the finding about the where LGBT students identified positive representations of LGBT topics in SPHE, English and History, but the percentages are 23%, 7% and 6% respectively. which is obviously a positive point in itself, but there's 34 or 37 other subjects on the post-primary syllabus. So I'm curious, like, I mean, I've seen reference in your documentation, you talk about here the inclusive curriculum. Mm. There's one issue about the inclusive curriculum as a document, but clearly what you were saying to Maureen a few moments ago about the environment of the school, the idea of inclusive curriculum as a lived process seems to be essential to your vision. Would that be fair? And how do you think, how might schools actually unpack that for themselves, do you think?
Well, I think it's just a confidence issue, isn't it, for teachers being able to drop it in very unselfconsciously about, somebody being LGBT or an issue around, I think it's a normalization. So when people become confident and it might take a bit of practice, but when it becomes just easier to do, then in your practice, I think students will notice that, and they'll notice the kind of how it just becomes commonplace to, not that it's, they don't have to be pointed out and, you know, big red neon signs going off or anything like that. It's just that it becomes totally normal and okay to talk about somebody and then to say, oh yeah, they happen to be LGBT, or, you know, this playwright talks about their experiences of being gay or being transgender or whatever subject you're talking about. I think hopefully we'll get to a point in the not too distant future where that's, you know, where all staff, teaching staff, feel confident to do that.
And like you say, you've met and we've met them too, Monita, in Fales. So we the INTO LGBT branch would be regular showcasers at our festival at the very beginning, actually, which I'm delighted to note. But those schools you've met and those teachers you've met where there was really inclusive environment, strong, healthy, positive practice in terms of all the good things you're talking about, what marks them out as particularly good examples of practice? And I suppose, in particular, in term, for any teachers and school leaders maybe listening who are listening to this podcast, what could they, if they were to meet those people that you've met in schools as teachers and principals who are doing the right way and going about it the right way, what might be they looking out for? What might they pick up from the good practice that's happening out there?
Well, the big things, I suppose, that young people said to us is feeling, when there are homophobic remarks made, that staff intervene. That's a big thing, so that may seem simple enough, but that is huge for a young person. And it's because the opposite can be devastating. You're looking for the adult in the classroom or on the corridor to have your back. It shouldn't be up to the LGBT young person who is a victim of this, or they may just be hearing it. They could be walking by and hearing it, and the other thing is to say, it's up to go off on a tangent, but like, you don't have to be LGBT to experience LGBT bullying. I can't tell you how many, especially men I know who, because they weren't into a certain kind of sport in school, were bullied for being gay, and so there is, it's probably part of a broader issue around gender roles and stereotypes and toxic masculinity and all that. So, but back to your original question, I think it's really important that, schools send out the message. I think a way that schools do, some ways schools do it is by participating in stand-up awareness week. So they run the stand-up and they let students as well, but they let the board of management, they let all the parents know, they let everybody, and everybody's invited in. So it becomes not just about what's happening in the classroom. It can be a celebration, they can have past LGBT students in. Sometimes they've had, if they've had a famous, somebody famous in their school, they invite them back in to talk about it, or even not that famous, but they might just want to talk about their experiences. Raising the rainbow flag. Last year, lots of schools did the jumper day on the last day. So they every year took a color of the rainbow flag. They wore in a jumper that color, and the photos of that were just incredible. Having the posters up around the school, making sure that everybody's aware of about the school policies, including it in the curriculum. I mean, there's just so many ways that schools are doing great work. But mostly, I suppose it's the leadership, as Maureen mentioned, being vocal about it, being vocal that your LGBT students are welcome here and you belong here, and we don't tolerate bullying or exclusion. Another way, I suppose has been, especially lately, is seeing schools being really inclusive of trans students and taking a very practical, very pragmatic approach to some of the issues that come up then when somebody may change from being male to female, from 1 year to the next, and how the school supports the student with that transition. So loads of examples of great stuff, great practice that's going on in schools all over Ireland. And I have to say as well, the ethos thing for lots of schools, I've heard some great schools say it's because of their religious ethos that they are inclusive. That's because of their Christian values that they have to make sure that nobody is experiencing discrimination or being made feel less than or not included or not welcome because of their gender identity or sexual orientation. So I think, again, back to the leadership and setting the tone and setting, the vision and recognizing that you can't cure this overnight, This kind of bullying is endemic. It's not just happening in our schools. It's happening in our communities. It's happening online. Unfortunately, it's even happening in our school, in our homes. We still are supporting young people who experience homelessness because of they aren't accepted at home. But I think when a school recognizes that it goes on and they then name it and they address it, it's like the whole recording of bullying. If you can't record it, if you can't name it, if you're saying it doesn't happen in your school, well, then you have your head in the sand, because that's not true. It can't not be happening in your school. It's happening everywhere. But the reality is, when you know what's going on, you can name it, then you can address it, and you can change it, and you can make it better.
Just wondering there, Manina, as you were talking, it kind of struck me a little bit, I suppose, along the lines, if you can't see it, you can't be it. I wonder how many teachers in our schools are now openly gay, and pupils would be aware of, and would pupils be aware of that? And if pupils and the rest of the school community were aware that they had LGBT members on the staff, do you think that would contribute to the normalizing of it in the whole school community?
I suppose, Maureen, it depends on how the experience of those LGBT teachers. Do you know what I mean? So if they're shown respect and they're valued and all that, and they're celebrated, I think it has a hugely positive impact on young people. Absolutely. That role modeling is so important. If I'd had out teachers in my school, I think it would have made a huge difference, but if the teachers aren't out, or they're out but they're ridiculed, or they're bullied by students or by staff, or things are said about them and nothing is done, nothing is addressed, well, I think it can have a devastating impact on young people, because the young person then goes, well, if a teacher can't be out, if they can't be out, well,
that's
then
the hope for me.
I'm not coming out. Yeah, yeah.
So, but tell us about your campaign then in that space, Monina. There was a line in your report that really struck me. The tagline was, if everybody chose to come in, nobody would have to come out. Tell us more about what's behind the thinking there, please.
Sure. Well, we know that coming out is still the biggest issue that we get calls and emails from young people about. In fact, 58% of all contacts made to us for support are about coming out. It's still can be a really challenging, scary time for a young person because they're worried about rejection. You know, will my family, will my parents, will my siblings still love me, or my carer, my guardian? Or will my friends still accept me, or will I be excluded and bullied? You know, it's really a big leap of faith for a lot of people when they're coming out. So it can be very scary. And I guess how we might remove that and the consequence of that then can lead to all sorts of mental health problems and LGBT young people have much higher risk of mental health problems and because of these kind of issues and challenges that they face. And Dr. Niall Muldoon, the Ombudsman for Children, speaks really eloquently about this. You know, he's a child psychologist, and he talks about, you know, it's that shame. It's the fear of somebody finding out, somebody outing me before I'm ready to come out, or will they like me anymore? That's what has a negative impact on a person, not because they're LGBT. It's the worry and the fear of being accepted for who they are and loved for who they are. So I guess what this campaign tries to do is turn that on its head and say, look, if we all just came out, if we all just said we're all allies, we all accept LGBT people for who they are, and you know, we celebrate you. It doesn't matter to us. It's not a I knew anyway. It's not that. Mm-hmm. It's not belittling it. It's just saying it's wonderful. We have LGBT people in our families, in our communities, in our circle of friends, and we celebrate you, and we're all coming in as your allies. And then I suppose it takes the spotlight off. Takes the pressure off LGBT young people to have to come out. And also, they can come out whenever they like. And the other thing is, coming out is a continual process. I'm 47, as I said before, and I still have to come out. You know, if I'm, not that I've been doing this lately, but if I have to book a hotel, or even buying health insurance or anything. We have a daughter, so if we to bring her see, you know, well, our GP knows she has two moms, but if she's to go to a specialist or anything like that, it's a continual process of coming out. So I guess back to that, if everybody just came in and we just knew everybody was an ally and everybody was supportive, take the pressure off, especially young people who might worry a little bit more about other people accepting them than I might at my age. I don't care so much. It's their problem, not mine. But a 16-year-old me wouldn't have felt that way. You know, I would have worried very much about my peers and my parents accepting me.
But there's something profoundly heartbreaking, as I listened to Monine, about young people. The sentence you said a few moments ago about the anxiety about coming out can be related to a fear that they won't be as loved, or they think they won't be loved if they come out. And it seems to me something's getting lost in translation here. Something that, you know, my own parents have said to me when I was going to my teenage years, no matter what you do, you must come and talk to us. Don't ever be afraid to come and talk to us. And in my own translation to my own children, my eldest daughter is turning 17 actually this month. I said to her recently, your worth as a human being is unconditional. And it's beyond the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which has obviously a force in terms of we have inalienable rights as human beings. But from a moral point of view, a spiritual point of view, don't ever think, you know, your worth depends on results, or your worth depends on this, or your worth depends on the other. But from what you're saying, Monina, I was also very struck earlier on, he said about the most common age for forming your identity is around the age of 12. But the most common age for actually beginning to come out is 16. The 4 years in between can be very, very challenging. So for young people who are listening to this podcast and are in that zone and are worried about, I won't be as loved if I do come out now, what would you say to them given the overall experience you're describing?
Well, I would say, first of all, that you're not alone, and to get in contact with us and belong to, we're there for you. That's what we were set up for, is to support LGBT young people through this kind of sometimes tricky period of self-acceptance and And exploring and understanding, you know, your gender identity or sexual orientation. So get in touch with us and we'll support you and answer any questions. And you might find a community, make some friends, and, you know, and through all that, I think we help build your resilience and really see that, you know, being LGBT can be a wonderful thing. I love being a member of the LGBT community, and it's great to have friends and to have all sorts of experiences through that, and also that we know from the same research that showed the vulnerability in terms of mental health for young LGBT people, older LGBT people, especially over 26, the vast majority of them are very, very happy to be LGBT and are very happy to be out and are living their lives and are thriving. So I would say that if you feel alone and you feel like you're struggling at the moment, that, you know, not to give up hope and that there is help there. And for, you know, for very, very many LGBT young people, when they come out to family and friends, they are accepted and loved and celebrated, and very little changes except for it. Your anxiety goes down and you get to be yourself and you don't have to hide anymore. For some, it takes a little bit more time. I know even in my own case, and I came out much later in life, it took my mum a while to get used to it, you know. And what I would say to young people listening is, or parents listening, is that an LGBT person probably has had a few years to think about it. So maybe go easy on the people who are around you, who love you. It might take them a little while to get their heads around us as well. So in the meantime, look to us, look to Belong To or your local LGBT youth club for that support you need. There are other people who can, you know, maybe virtually hold your hand through this time until, you know, your family or your friends around you come around to that. But the vast majority of people will. They come around, and if they don't, we're there to support you, and we can hopefully, if we can't provide the specific support you need, we can signpost you to lots of other great organizations, agencies who are more specialized. We work with, for example, Pieta House, so for young people who are experiencing, yeah, you know, self-harm or suicide ideation, there's support there for you. So there's no issue too big or too small, really, to come to us with. If you're just feeling a bit down in the dumps or something like that, or you just have a question, you know, get in touch with us. You're never alone. And outside office hours, there's a crisis text line, 50808, 24/7, a free crisis text line. I know from talking to the people working in there that very many of their texts are from LGBT young people, so they've loads of experience and they're there for you anytime, the night or day, if there's something troubling you.
50808 is the text number, Money, is it?
That's right.
Nina, that's something terribly profound, I suppose. You know, I never had to come out as a heterosexual female. That there is this, you know, that somebody would be. I really think I'm starting to get that if everybody was in, none of us would have to come out, that this concept of being othered can be extremely difficult. And I have a son who is 24, but I figure his teenage years were difficult enough. I look back on my own puberty, which is ancient history, and that was probably difficult enough without feeling I had this othered piece as well on top of it. So I just feel that there is, you know, there is an expectation there, you know, when we expect that people will come out, or that you still have to make these explanations as to why you are booking in with your partner, or, you know, there's just something terribly profound and goes so deep into our psyche and our society. Such fundamental change is needed.
Well, it's something that we explore a little bit in our training. We have free online training for teachers on belongto.org. It's a 2.5 hours and available to anyone who will find it useful. But one of the modules is around unconscious bias. And I mean, we all have it, you know, it's that part of our brain that probably kept our ancestors alive when saber-toothed tigers jumped out from behind a boulder, you know, things like that. Well, maybe we weren't alive when they were around, but anyway.
You call it the lizard.
I was never very good.
Speaking of ancient history.
So, but anyway, that's part of the brain that helped us. So if there were Vikings coming over the hill and they were going to, you know, steal all our food and all our women, you know, that we would head into flight or fight and we would run or we would fight them. And so that's still there. And we still have that reaction to anything that's different, anything that's different. So that could be somebody of a different race, somebody of different gender identity or sexual orientation or, you know, different faith. It can be anything. But the reality is that thankfully we also have this new part of our brain that's developed where we can rationalize and we can have thought and we can go, okay, well, listen, they may be of a different race or a different sexual orientation to me, but that is not going to harm me. And therefore I can calm down. My brain can calm down and I don't need to have this reaction, this negative reaction to this person being different. It's a muscle and we have to practice it, you know? So Panty Bliss talks about this in her famous Abbey theatre speech, you know, about checking herself and the unconscious bias and that we all have it. And even LGBT people have it. And it's, people will say offhand remarks and I'll have to go, wait a second, you know what you just said, you know, and I do it myself, I'm sure, but you have to continuously just find yourself and just practice it. And then, you know, so I think some of that is then the realization about the coming out thing. I think when you know that, now that that light's gone off in your head, Maureen, you won't unlearn it. You will realize that. So I think the likelihood of you reading everybody as heterosexual or as cisgender, yes, you know, in the gender that they were assigned at birth is probably hugely reduced because that light's gone off in your brain now, realizing, God, I read everybody as heterosexual until they come out.
Until I'm told differently.
We all do until you train your brain not to. And that's why, you know, teachers who and parents who keep the language very neutral, keep pronouns neutral, keep, you know, talking about boyfriends and girlfriends neutral, all that, all those little signs make it safe for young people to open up and not have to police themselves and feel more comfortable about then sharing their own experiences with whether that's their parents or their teachers or whoever, you know.
From a teacher's point of view, Molina and Maureen, you have to stifle the urge to laugh now when I say this, but there's a huge piece around reflective practice, which is obviously a core piece of the teaching council's work, which are also reminding me of Caroline Sheeran from Hibernia College speaking of inclusive education in the round, so to speak, said that when we seek to include, we automatically exclude. And when I heard her say this, I was horrified. I said, sure to God, we're doomed then. There's no point in even trying. And she was saying, no. She said, you make the honest effort to include. Being human, come back to your point, Monina, you know, there's an unconscious bias. You'll miss something or somebody in that well-intentioned effort. But as long as you've got the honesty and the courage to stop and think and look and realise what you've missed and try again, well, that's the honesty of the human endeavour. What, you know, what they often talk about in well-being terms, the unconditional kindness, which is a huge, I think, theme around what all you're saying, the unconditional kindness of teachers to students, of students to each other, or students to their families and vice versa. If we all would just give us a little bit more space to get our heads around this and not to be, you can use a cliche, but that piece around the inclusion, the best of intentions, and when we don't get it right, how we can be so hard on ourselves, there's a huge piece in that, isn't there really?
Absolutely. And we say that to teachers all the time. It's about your intention, you know, and if you mess up, you just apologize. And you learn. We learn from our mistakes. That's how we learn, you know. And I think young LGBT people know that, and they recognize that. And when they know that it was your teacher or your parent was trying to be inclusive, and they just messed up, and they're sorry. No offense is taken. You know, people realize that especially terminology is changing so fast as our understanding of, you know, I mean, look, when we were growing up, sex, gender, sexuality, we didn't barely have said those words, you know, let alone realizing that there was anything but a binary, you know, and now we understand that sexual orientation, there's a spectrum of experiences all the way from being absolutely heterosexual to absolutely, you know, homosexual or asexual, and lots of, you know, sexualities and experiences in between. And we're starting to understand that, like, that gender is also on that spectrum. So you can have somebody who's male, somebody who's female, or somebody who experiences gender somewhere in between along that spectrum. And some of them are transgender because they experience their gender as different to the one that they were assigned at birth, or some are non-binary. So they either they don't experience being either male or female, or neither exclusively. So our understanding has become more nuanced, I suppose, and will continue to until we move beyond having to label.
Yeah.
And until then, we're going to make mistakes. I make mistakes. I misgender young people from time to time, and I just say, "Oh, I'm sorry. I won't do that again. I realize I made a mistake there." And they say, "No problem, no problem," and we move on. You know, I think you're right. It's being kind to each other and kind to ourselves. It's about the intention. I think it's really about intention. You're intending not to do harm, and you're intending to make that young person feel included, feel visible, feel valued, and feel included. And young people will appreciate that authenticity.
In terms of increasing visibility, and as you say, more open and inclusive honesty and kindness to each other, Monina, Stand Up Week, and you referenced it earlier on, and you give us a flavour of it. To anybody who's listening, be they a teacher, a parent, or a student, what's the week about? What happens? What kind of events take place? What goes on during Stand Up Week?
Well, Stand Up Week happens, it's happening this week between the 16th and the 20th of November, and it's the largest anti-LGBT plus bullying campaign in second level schools, and this is our 11th year. And so PACS went out to all schools there over the last few weeks. They should be in schools now. They're probably with everybody's principals. You can download them from our website as well, belongtothe.org, or you can give the office a call, and they have a few extra PACS hard copies as well if you want us to pop them in the post to you. We've done our training for the year. So we have our online training that's available anytime for teachers, but we do stand-up specific training for post-primary teachers in the kind of September, October time. And we had a great engagement from teachers from all over the country for that. And it was great. I mean, the best thing that they learn is from each other, and they're talking about, this happened in my school. And, you know, so they share practice, share good ideas, and share learnings from mistakes as well. So the week itself then, in the PACS, it's really about having a really positive week in school where, you know, making LGBT young people feel visible, valued, and included. So lots of schools do different things. They can do art installations, they can do plays, they can, you know, make sure in different classes and different subjects there's inclusion of LGBT identities and experiences. And then it all culminates on the Friday of that week, where we have our come-in day, and people, teachers and our staff and students wear the different colored jumpers, and it's really, you know, something wonderfully inclusive. And again, it's about teaching young people not to be bystanders, but to be upstanders for their friends. So when they hear language being used that could cause harm, to feel confident, to have the language and to have the confidence to call it out and to do something about it, and to know that their school has the policies and the processes in place so that if they want to, they can, you know, report it, and the school will take action. and really about just creating a more positive, more inclusive space. Again, taking the spotlight off the LGBT students themselves and making everybody feel included. Because, I mean, lots of people wait until they leave school to come out. So there's a lot of young people still in post-primary mm-hmm. school who would never come out. So it's great that they can enjoy this as well with their pals and know when they're ready to, when they feel safe, they can come out and tell their pals and they'll know that they will be accepted because sure, didn't we have, you know, don't we celebrate this every year and we talk about LGBT history and films and books and culture and, you know, whatever subjects they find something to talk about to do with the lived experiences of LGBT people, either here in Ireland or around the world.
Benigna, coming from the primary school perspective, when you said at the start that children are very aware at 12 that they begin to read, you know, in general, is there an awareness campaign for primary schools, for the higher end of the primary school? Have you developed anything like that?
Well, we have our Altogether Now resources on our, so they're still available. Unfortunately, we don't have the capacity, we don't have the resources to really support primary schools with this work. The resources are there.
Different families, same love, and those posters.
Altogether Now were resources developed by a team in St. Pat's and DCU around how to, you know, bring human rights and equality and diversity and LGBT identities and experiences into the classroom aligned with, you know, the curriculum. So they're there, but you're right, I'd love to be able to do it because, I mean, there's so many 12-year-olds now in, you know, mm-hmm. it's sixth class. And, you know, we get calls from teachers and principals and parents of primary school teachers every day. But unfortunately, we don't have the capacity to do much more than offer them support on the phone and send them the link to the resources on our website. But I know, look, my own daughter, as I said before, is in primary school and I've been in because I'm a parent. I've been in talking to the school and the teachers and the parents. Of neighboring schools as well around it, because it is something I suppose that parents are much more aware of, and they want the language, they want to be saying the right thing, they want to be sending the right messages out to their children so that their children feel comfortable to talk to them about these issues and, you know, don't feel that they you know, that it's a big deal, and they just want to be saying the right things, you know, and not messing up. But mostly what we say to them is just, you know, take a breath, read some of our stuff on our website. And once you just, you know, are making those signals to the young people in your lives that, you know, you are an ally and, you know, you read this, you saw this, you spoke to this person, you know, celebrating Pride every summer is a really good thing to do, I think, that schools can do and that households can do, even if there's no LGBT people out in their families or out in their classrooms. It's still a lovely thing to do. There could be children in the class who have same-sex parents, you know, and so then they feel their families are valued and respected. So you just never know.
No, you don't. And it's, I suppose, back to handling it with humanity at all times. I suppose nothing in our training or our teacher education prepared us for the society we have now, and all we can do is be a person and be the best person that you can in whatever role you're fulfilling, you know.
Yeah.
But arguably, I suppose if you remember that as teachers were taught, particularly in primary, and I say this as a post-primary teacher by back of myself, Maureen, but we're taught to start with the child, the learner. And implicit in that, maybe not sufficiently explicit, is their unconditional worth, who they are. And once you start, but I pick up for you, Monina, more and more, it's been really coming towards the end of our time, unfortunately, but that unconditional kindness, the importance of the shared, I mean, I think it's however heartbreaking the circumstances may be, and the sense of isolation and loneliness, particularly young people going through this space may feel at times, you describe a fantastic array of supports. We may always want more and more resources for those supports, but there's an awful lot out there as it is. And I was very struck by the tagline for your strategic plan, you know, sharing the learning. I think I have a better sense now of why you chose that title from how you've spoken and what you've had to say. Presumably that title was chosen very carefully, the sharing of the learning, Monina.
Yeah, well, we belong to around 16 years. I came aboard after the marriage equality campaign, having worked as director for 8 years. And they, you know, Michael Barron, the founder, set up Belong to in a very different time and created a space and for supports, but also for discussion around what needed to change policy wise and that. And I think we were at a stage in our development, I suppose, that we had all this knowledge and all this know-how and the skill and expertise. And I think it really, we've been doing it in ad hoc ways, sharing that learning, we're doing training, little bits of training here and there, but this strategic period is really about upping that and sharing that, and we now have a new education and training person on board, Sharon Murray, and she is leading out on our Safe and Supportive Schools program, which we are launching later on this month. So we have a pilot with 15 schools, actually 20 schools at this stage, who are going to go through that. It's a toolkit. It's a whole school community change process, I suppose, looking at all these various different things like policy, training, space, community, all the different ways a school can change their culture and really embed stuff so that, you know, very often what happens is you have one or two great teachers in a school, they do some training, they do some great work, and then when they move on, a lot of that learning is lost in terms of LGBT inclusion. So what this tries to do is really embed it into the culture. And the two massive schools in Donegal completed the process with us a few years ago and really had a very lasting impact. So a year later, when the evaluations came back, you know, the culture really had changed in terms of inclusion and diversity and for all students, not just LGBT students. So we're going to be doing that. We're doing similarly then focusing on youth services and trying to make them safe and supportive. So whether they're LGBT specific or mainstream, open to all young people, working to share our learning, share expertise, and bring youth services through, I suppose, an accreditation process and similar to the one that we're at schools. So it really is about, I suppose, passing on. We'll never be able to do all the training and all the support and across nationwide. We're too small a team, so it's really about training other trainers who can share that learning and that ripple out effect then, so that in a few years' time, hopefully whenever a young person comes in contact with, you know, whether it's a school or a service, that they will know that they are welcome and that they belong there.
I think it's a lovely note to finish on, Monina, in many ways. We call this series Light in the Fire, and you know, I won't speak for Maureen, but certainly for me, you've given many sparks of hope and of insight that I hope those who are listening to podcasts, whether it's during the stand-up week or sometime thereafter, will take to light fires of their own. If it's about paying it forward in that positive way, there's a reality that's can be sad and heartbreaking for people at a particular moment in time, but we need to remind ourselves of the positive supports that are there too. And I think that you've certainly helped to spark a few fires in my own heart and mind as you've spoken there, and it's been an absolute pleasure to listen to you. You've enlightened, you've taught yourself and Maureen, certainly. Maureen,
I just want to thank Monina. You have given me a lot of food for thought, and I think I will be lighting fires for quite some time in conversations about this, because I think it's something that we all need to think about a lot more and all need to work a lot harder on. to make sure that our schools are safer, happier, secure places for all our children, not just our LGBT children, especially, I suppose. Thank you so much. When my aunt, Hannah Vosca Jo, agus anachid over machnav thumsa an sin. So, míle brechas, Malina.
Absolute pleasure to be to join you today, and honoured to be your first guest. I started in marriage equality as director, but 2007, when very few people at that time believed we'd achieve marriage equality. But that was my dream, and we achieved it. And so wiping out homophobic and transphobic bullying in schools and making sure that they're safe and inclusive spaces for all learners is definitely my dream, and I hope I know both of you will share that dream, and when we keep on dreaming and hopefully achieve that over the next few years.
I think we will. You remind me to speak, Bonilla. You may know her as well, but I'm sure listeners of the podcast will remember fondly Bianca Nigrogoyne. She was a primary teacher who passed away at a very young age some years ago. And she wrote in a blog, I think, very movingly of the moment, I think when the count has been announced in the marriage referendum, it was in the courtyard of Dublin Castle. And it so happened there was a conference on in the print works. So she was standing, I think, as she writes the blog, in the foyer of the conference centre, able to see and hear the crowd in the courtyard as the result has been announced, which is obviously central to her own identity and a cause dear to her heart. But also on the fringes of our other big passion in life, which was professional learning, innovation, experimentation with colleagues. And she was in that beautiful moment and space between the two. But unfortunately, Bianca's no longer with us. But I think her energy and her passion, her love of people and her love of learning still carry through. And clearly they carry through what you've had to see here as well. So we have a way to go yet, but I haven't listened to you carefully enough for the last hour or more. It's been, I'm very, very hopeful. And not naive, but I'm very hopeful, and I want to thank you so much for yes, we're delighted to have you as our first guest, but it's been our privilege and honor too to have had you as our first guest, and you set a very high bar, Monina. Let me emphasize that for guests to come down the line. So folks, just as we come to the end of this podcast, I want to thank most sincerely Monina for taking part in this podcast conversation. I'm sure you found, what's that to say, thought-provoking, inspirational, sobering, all in equal measure. But one way of the morning healer, as about morning head, the Lord of Horse, Aaron Trapp, put Realty Show. I want to thank morning healer for being our very first guest host. And you've done a stellar job, morning. So we may have you back in the future. We basically may have to talk in the Machin Show. No gallant see now, but the Bechzad. And to our listeners on this podcast, just please don't forget to subscribe to our podcast, Lighting the Fire, All Things Teaching and Learning. Don't forget to subscribe to that in the usual way. You can find us on all major podcast channels, and we will be releasing podcasts on a regular basis. And if you enjoyed it, please do take the time to leave a review and, of course, share the show via your usual hyperlink on social media and so on with your networks and friends. We're really keen to light fires of conversations as far and as wide as possible. If you want to get in touch with us in the Teaching Council, please do contact us via Twitter. That's @TeachingCouncil. Or, of course, you can email us directly on communications@teachingcouncil.ie. You can send in ideas for interviewees or comments and episodes already broadcast. We really love to hear from you. We welcome all feedback on all our media engagements, including this podcast series. Gonna hit them with it, but when we'll say what it was about gay stuff, the show with Musulga Murshabeka, it was Lacosta Binky of the Rella. We look forward to chatting to you all next time in our next podcast. So long.